the ETC podcast. If you're hearing this, welcome to Real Talk, not the evening news. It's just a father and his sons talking life, family, politics, and anything else the world throws our way. No scripts, no filters, just honest conversation. The kind families used to have around the kitchen table before everybody started arguing online. Pull up a chair and join the conversation. This is the ETC Podcast.
Welcome to the ETC Podcast, episode number one, recorded on November 6, 2025. My name is Tom, and I have with me Eric. We're going to call him Ryan, and of course, T is Tom, and C is Chase. So we have Eric and Chase. Take a moment, introduce yourselves.
So I'll go on and get us started. Tom, thanks for the introduction. So I'm Eric on this side of the podcast. Eric, Ryan, wherever you call me, just don't call me late for dinner. So essentially what's going on here is, you know, we talked at our dinner table as per we do when during holiday or events, something like that, something comes up. We always take time to have a conversation after dinner is generally how this concept came to be. So a little background about myself. I've been in the IT industry for around about 3 years now. I've been working hands-on as a field technician for the last year, and I really like to get to know the users at a ground level. That's why I ended up with this job. So an easy way to think of me is okay when it comes to hands-on work. I like to be outside a little bit. I used to do airsoft back in the day, considering about getting back into it. And I promise I will not let my feelings of the Carolina Panthers stop or hurt this podcast. But that's a little introduction about myself. Hopefully, hear more about me as time goes down the line. But let me go on and, you know, throw the floor over to my brother, Chase.
Hey, what's going on? Yeah, I'm Chase. I'm a mechanic by trade, but in my own time, I enjoy politics, movies, video games, history, all kinds of stuff, and spending time with my wife.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome, guys. So I'm Tom. Dad, this is kind of a dream of mine to start a podcast. And what better way to do that is with your kids and kind of the conversation that you have around the dinner table. So I've got nearly 30 years of IT experience. I've worked for everyone from Fortune 500 companies all the way down to nonprofit small businesses. Did a little bit of a ministry for a while as well. And a little retail management, but primarily my main career has been in the IT field. Starting this podcast was pretty exciting to me, and that's kind of why we're here. And of course, the name came from all three of our initials. So we are the ETC Podcast. You can find out more information about us at etcpodcast.com. The website should be up shortly. And you'll find this podcast where all good podcasts are found, Apple, Spotify, Google Play Store, all of those places where you can find podcasts, you will find this podcast. So I'm pretty excited about that. So let's kind of get into some of the conversations. So this is going to be a format similar to a dinner table conversation. So every time we get together, we tend to talk. Depending on the time of the year, it's oftentimes a political related or, you know, family and that sort of thing as well. So it's pretty exciting to get together and have these type of conversations. The format's probably going to be a little less than an hour each time. And our goal is to publish these out every week. And we may have some different types of shows, some different formats. We might have some guests, that sort of thing as we grow. But in the meantime, kind of the big thing in the news this week is the elections. There was a big election in New York City for the mayor's race, and as well as some other state governor races and such around the country. And I know that is a big talking point right now in the media, and I just want to kind of get everybody's take on that. So, a self-proclaimed socialist won the New York mayor's race. It looks like a couple hundred thousand votes, give or take. So what's your guys' thoughts on that? And kind of what do you think about that?
Yeah, so when I see it, I think it's more of an issue. Well, not really an issue, but the way I see it is kind of like an eye-opener for Republicans in New York City, hopefully New York and Virginia and a couple of these places. I mean, you know, some of this information that I've seen coming out, a lot of this election was put more towards, you know, people worrying about the touchy topic of, you know, healthcare. We're on what, day 35, I think, of government shutdown. And that is what I think played a big part in the role of this election. I mean, at least that's what I've seen in my places. You know, I don't have the exact numbers, so I don't really want to start throwing things out. I know for a fact that when you started looking at this stuff, it really came down to, you know, the winner of New York versus, and I may butcher the name, so Tom, Chase, if you want to help me, that'd be great. I'm not a great talker, but I know a little bit. It basically came down to the Independent Party, I think. It came down to, you know, Cuomo versus, you want to go on? I see you want to chime in.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to, Andrew Cuomo and Mondami.
Yeah, so basically how I seen it was, it went through that race, but I'm not going to lie and not say that, was it Siluia? Is that how you say the name?
Siluia.
Yeah. And then also West was also on the ballot, even though he quit running early. So I did look. There was a good portion of the audience, but I mean, I didn't get to fully add it up, but I think even adding it up completely, I don't know if Republicans could have took that, or I don't know if we would have had a different victor regardless of who was running. I mean, just by the poll numbers alone, unless you guys have a different opinion.
I mean, my thought process on it is it's not super surprising for me. It's, I mean, major cities, they're not getting any further towards the center. I think we can all agree that they're just going to continue going left for the foreseeable future. So, and I'm interested to see how this plays out. I mean, you know, my understanding is that Mondami seems to believe that his policies, and as Tom said, self-proclaimed socialist, will lead to a better New York, and, you know, just essentially that's going to work out different than what we've seen throughout history, which it's kind of hard to compare it as well. So, I mean, he's not like, he doesn't just have supreme reign over New York City. I think we all know that, you know, obviously there's other hoops that he's going to have to jump through. He doesn't just get to say what he wants to do and it just happens. So yeah, but I'm interested to see just how far he can go as far as the promises that he made, you know, government subsidized grocery stores. And obviously I think he planned to do some work in, I guess, the New York housing, as far as trying to have government intervention there. So I'm just interested to see how it plays out. This is either going to, in my opinion, it's going to turn out as, well, something the Republicans are going to say, well, this is why you can't vote this in. Or if you never know, we could be surprised and say, well, some of these things he's doing, is it may be working. I don't think that's going to happen, but I'm just interested to see how it goes.
Yeah, and yeah. One thing I wanted to talk about, oh, sorry for cutting you off, but I finally got these statistics that I had saved. And when you look at New York, 41.2% said that their number one hope for this city in 10 years is that everything will be more affordable and accessible. That's through Partnership for New York City. 34.4% said that they would like buildings to be more affordable, so like housing, essentially, to be more affordable. That is also a partnership for New York City, specifically in Brooklyn. 45% said housing costs are the biggest financial burden. 81% said the housing costs have gotten worse. Obviously, you got crime and public safety, transit infrastructure. 47.9% respondents said better, more reliable public transit would most improve their daily commute. And I mean, just kind of kicking this information over to you, Tom, what's your kind of take on this?
Well, so overall, you know, I've heard words like this is a blue wave, or this is a start of, you know, what the next midterm election cycle is going to be next year. And I kind of disagree because you look at New York City historically, you know, they've had more Democratic mayors than they have Republican mayors. Now, they've had a few Republicans. You've got Rudy Giuliani and and some other folks over the years, you know, America's mayor. You know, the big thing is this is Democratic stronghold. I mean, looking at D.C. registered vote, or excuse me, D.C., New York City registered voters, there's 4.5 million Democrats registered voters in the city. Only 530,000 Republicans and a little over a million independents and 330,000 minor party registered voters. So when you look at that, the Democrats outweigh the Republicans, you know, what, 10, basically ninefold, nine or tenfold. So that in itself is going to make it very difficult for a Republican to win. You know, is it possible? Absolutely. Do we need better candidates? Do we need candidates that can look at what issues the city has? You know, these issues that Ryan just shared, transportation. You know, how do we fix transportation? What's the Republican answer for that? How do we make housing affordable? I'm not sure that forcing landlords to not raise their rent or putting rent controls in place or freeze rent is the right answer. You know, housing is extremely expensive in New York City, but, you know, how do you fix it? I don't have the answer off the top of my head, but we, you know, as a Republican Party member, you know, lifetime Republican Party member, we need to look at those issues that the people of these large cities are concerned about, and we need to have very clear solutions to those issues, and we need to communicate those to the communities, and that would help. You know, is socialized grocery stores going to work? Probably not. Typically in places that have government-controlled grocery stores, the shelves are empty. There's no food. People have to stand in line. That's very common in those type of situations. But I think that's the answer for Republicans, is to listen to the people and then come up with real solutions to solve those issues and put them on the table and communicate them very well. We're doing better at that, I think, as a party nationally. But locally, in some of these large cities, we really have a hard time getting over that hurdle. And I mean, that's a giant hurdle. 4.5 million registered voters on the Democratic side versus, 530,000 Republican voters. I mean, that's a really huge hurdle to get across. So you're going to have, even as a Republican candidate to win New York City, they're going to have to be kind of center, middle of the road. I think in those situations, we may have a chance of picking up some of these large cities. Go ahead.
Yeah. And to that matter, I do agree. I mean, I'm looking at Independent Voter Project, just a website that tries to get, you know, nonpartisan information, you know, nothing that's advertised outside of, you know, what we know. And in New York specifically, not looking at Virginia or California or any of the, or New Jersey or any of the other places that was up for key elections a couple of days ago. So what we know, Democrats, 47.38%. So they're almost at 48% alone in the Democratic Party when it comes to New York. Republicans are roughly 22.79%, and independent or unaffiliated no-party voters are at 25.27%. So just further pressing what you're saying about needing a centralist Republican to be on these ballots, and in my opinion, would go a long way. But the problem is unifying that unaffiliated no party, you know, that it could be a very broad age range. So, of course, different problems are going to matter within that specific no party group. I would like to see an actual breakdown of how these non-voters, what they voted for. You know, like not per se who, but what main points of this election caused them to vote for who. I mean, that I think that alone would answer a lot of questions for New York. But I think this raises a question within these bigger cities. Is the Republican Party doing enough to keep things affordable? I think that's a major talking point within the next couple of years to come before the major election. Well, I know it's New York. We're probably never going to win that again in a presidential election, or at least for the upcoming times. But, you know, what can Republicans do to push affordability? And that's really all I wanted to say. Do you have anything you would like to add, Chase?
Not so much, really. I mean, I'm also not surprised by most of these results right now. Even though, you mentioned the government shutdown earlier. That's it's unfortunately something that does hurt Republicans. Even though I think we've all seen that 13 times it's been voted on for a clean CR, which is just to continue funding as it was, and it's been shut down every time by the Democrats. But unfortunately, that still tends to end up, at least to the public view, when you look at the polls that come out about these type of shutdowns, it usually tends to show that Republicans are the ones taking the hit for it. So when you add that fuel onto the fire, plus when you have, a Republican president or a Democrat president, the opposite party tends to start taking seats when you have the off-year elections like that. So I know we're not talking about congressional right now. We're just talking about a couple governors, attorney generals, things like that. But it's just I think it's pretty well status quo, but Zora Mondani is definitely not status quo, though. I mean, that's probably as far left as we've seen thus far. And like I said, personally, my opinion is I don't think it's going to work out very well for New York City at all. And I think there's something to be worried about just as far as, I've heard a lot of bad things about, like, the crime rates in New York City and, what promises has he made to really work on that? How can he change that in a way that makes the city feel safer for a lot of people? But this is just from things that I've heard. Obviously, I'm not a New Yorker, just a speculation that I think is interesting.
Yeah, I would agree. It's kind of an interesting place that we're in as a country right now. I don't know. I feel like we're in a big experiment right now. I'm not surprised about the outcome of the elections on Tuesday. These were primarily Democratic controlled areas. I will say the Republicans did pretty well overall. Maybe they didn't win the race, but they still showed up. And did okay in areas that have leaned Democratic for years. It seems like Virginia kind of goes back and forth a bit with Democrat versus Republican. Their last governor was a Republican, but now they have a Democratic governor. She's interesting, to say the least. Don't know a ton about her. Haven't had a chance to really research a ton about her. But I do know that, they've not, lots of people aren't going to be happy about some of these decisions that they made long term. Unfortunately, you've got to live with those decisions. Some of these races are, 4 years, so they got to live with those people for the next 4 years. But anyway, so that's kind of an interesting topic. Let's kind of shift gears a little bit to the government shutdown. So, and kind of talk about the filibuster. So, and I'm not a political science major, or a civics expert by any means, but the U.S. Senate has a filibuster rule. Basically, states that you got to have 60 votes to pass certain legislation. Right now we have 51, 52 votes. So we're going to have some independents or some Democrats come alongside of us to really get any kind of legislation done, there's an opportunity, you know, in kind of a worst case scenario situation, you know, we could get rid of the filibuster. But what are the ramifications in the future if we get rid of the filibuster? It really gives the minority party at least a little bit of a say in what's going on in the Senate. You know, the House is a simple majority. You know, we have a large majority in the House, enough to get legislation through with no problem. You know, the House has voted past the continuing resolution. That's clean. The Senate, however, continues to be in a stalemate. The last voting that I saw, we had two or three Democrats come over. We lost a Republican. So I think we need five or six additional Democrats to vote yes in order to get the clean CR through. I'm hoping that they come to the table. I heard today that they're talking about cutting airline air traffic at the larger airports by 40%. You know, I've got a trip coming up here in a couple of weeks down to Florida. So, you know, I'm kind of concerned. Are my flights going to be canceled? Or, you know, do I need a backup to drive? That sort of thing. So really don't know what that's going to look like. I'm hoping that the Democrats have some momentum from the election and they're like, we need to end this. We need to make it look like it's a victory for us. And that we have a mandate and so forth and so on, which is exactly what they're going to do, or something similar to that, when the time comes, when they decide to fold and vote for the clean CR. You know, this is not anything special. This is exactly the same clean CR that Chuck Schumer put on the table during the Biden presidency. He is not voting for this now because it's Trump. And that's the only reason. It's Trump. He don't want to give Trump a win. You know, he wants the government to shut down. He wants to make it look like it's Republicans. But at the end of the day, the Republicans can't pass it because there's not enough Republicans in the Senate. So Democrats have to come on alongside. So get your act together, Democrats, and vote for this CR, and then come to the table and discuss a more proper budget and things that you guys want to negotiate, different deals, healthcare. You know, there's work that needs to be done there. Affordability of you know, different things in the U.S., that's very important. You know, what are your guys' thoughts on the government shutdown? You got anything to add with that?
Yeah, you know, you were speaking about the flights and the air traffic control. I think I read that the transportation secretary was essentially saying that, yes, you know, flights are going to be delayed and canceled, unfortunately, just due to lack of air traffic control, the ability to fund it right now. So that's a tough thing to deal with for anyone that travels, for sure. Yeah, I agree that this is definitely not the time and place to try to get a win on policy. And the biggest sympathy, I think, definitely goes out to, you know, the SNAP and EBT programs. You know, there's a lot of people that really do need that. And, you know, I just hate to see that they're losing funding and they're losing benefits because, again, like you said, they're still trying to push these policies through on affordable health care. And that is something that needs work, but not at the expense of, you know, children being able to have dinner at their table. It's definitely something to be worried about. So I think you got to do what you said. You got to just pass the continued funding for what had already been voted on and agreed to, and worry about the health care policies and ways to make that more affordable after, when there's going to be more time to discuss it, when the American people aren't being, you know, well, that large percentage is being starved, you know, from their benefits. And it's a scary thing to think about, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, and I'll give an example here. You know, I've done some work in nonprofits. So I kind of understand a little bit of this as far as the impact of SNAP and benefits on certain types of populations within our country. And, you know, I know folks that, you know, receive less than $1,000 a month to live off of. And those folks are going to get probably a couple hundred dollars worth of food stamps. Oftentimes they're single. They have their own apartment or home. They've got utilities that they've got to pay, all of these things. And they're relying very heavily, you know, at the end of the month, they have nothing left. I mean, literally down to the pennies. So the way it stands right now, you know, lots of people are stepping up, lots of food banks, lots of churches, lots of NGOs and nonprofits are stepping up to kind of fill that gap. And that's very helpful. I'm kind of a believer that, you know, this shouldn't really fall on the government in the first place. A lot of this should be handled by the private sector, nonprofits and organizations. The government wastes a ton. And these type of programs do have a ton of waste associated with them. But at the end of the day, the program is there as an emergency stop, you know, safety net for folks that are vulnerable and food insecure. And until we restructure these programs in such a way that, you know, the government's out of them, we can't just do this on a whim. It can't happen overnight. It's going to take years for that to happen. And, you know, it probably never will happen. But in the meantime, we've got to get these things funded. We've got to get money in the hands of the folks that need it so that they can purchase food.
I agree. And I just wanted to say, you know, because we were talking about, you know, the election of Zora Mondani earlier, you know, this is a big example of, you know, a lot of the policies that he's would be supporting, you know, to be worried about, because when the government can have, you know, large amounts of money like this to, for like SNAP and EBT programs, and that's a good thing for people who need it. But when it comes time for the government to just run out of money, or in other words, eventually if they had decided to do something else with the program in which the money wasn't being given to the people who needed it anymore, that's something to be really concerned about, is the government gives and the government can take away. And we're seeing a prime example of this right now.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that, because you've got to really, you should try to be as independent or not reliant on government help as much as possible. I mean, if you're an able-bodied American, get out and work. And I understand there's a lot of jobs out there and a lot of places that don't have the greatest economy, and maybe you're not making enough to support your family. We understand that. And that's what these programs are for. But I also know there's generations of families that live on the system constantly. And, you know, we've got to figure out how to resolve that issue. And how do we encourage those folks to get out and work, get out and be contributing members of this, the American dream.
I absolutely agree. And I thought it was interesting. From what I saw, I believe it was about a sixth of Americans were relying on these programs in some way. Someone may have to check my facts on that, but I believe it was over 40 some million Americans on this. And that seems like a really large number. What is our population now? Does anyone know? Is it over like 300 million or something like that? And I mean, to have the 40 some million on these programs, I'm finding it hard to believe. Yeah, 339 million. So, and that's just from the census. I'm finding it hard to believe that there are that many people that are not able to find work that could provide for their family. I, I'm I could be wrong, but it just seems doesn't seem exactly right. Like you said, with these mass government programs, there tend to be a lot of things that can slip through. So it's confusing.
And kind of my thought process on this, like, for example, I am a strong believer that states should be taking a more of a reign in this. Now, that is how I've always believed. I believe the state should have more rights when it comes to a lot of different things. And I believe SNAP is a perfect example of this. And I know that some of these states are using emergency funds and declaring state of emergencies, but just listen to some of these numbers that is released since the government shut down. So California has spent up to 80 million fast track to food banks statewide. New York declared a state of emergency and allocated 65 million to food banks. Michigan committed around 4.5 million to state food banks. Pennsylvania around 5 million in state funding to food banks, not even a state of emergency, just state funding. West Virginia pledged around $14 million to food banks in response to SNAP funding issues. And in my opinion, if this can be done when the government shut down, yes, I understand we may have to make some kind of tax break. We may have to or tax some kind of class or make some kind of new tax to appropriate this. But why can't these states invest this amount of money in food banks anyway? That is my take on it. Like, yes, SNAP is very important. I have been on SNAP. I understand how important it is. But at the same time, I believe states should kind of pick up their act and get more into helping their community, helping their counties. You should not rely on the government for everything. And that's just my two cents on it. That's how I feel about almost really anything. So, I mean, just listen to those numbers alone. Yes, there are states, more states donating that I do not have pulled up. But this is all from these individual state websites. This is not me pulling this from Fox News or CNN. This is me going to state officiated websites. You know, Governor of California, The Guardian, which, you know, is not a state ran, but you know, Michigan's website, Pennsylvania Municipal League, you know, all of these websites that I found so far, it is proving that the state government can take care of its people, and I think they should.
Yeah, so I'm gonna quote Ronald Reagan. I was doing a little bit of research and found a really good quote that really kind of spells this out really well. And in this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. I will tell you, Ronald Reagan was one of the best orators that I know, and really had some great sound bites, and that would be one of them. In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And that's the same thing with New York. The new mayor of New York City is basically setting people up to fail because he's setting people up to rely only on the government. What happens when the government goes bankrupt? What happens when the government can't pay their bills? What happens when people that are rich move out of New York City and are not paying taxes anymore? Where does the funding for these programs come from? Well, I mean, eventually, that model doesn't work. And, you know, we've seen that time and time again with communism and socialism and things like that throughout history. So it's just an interesting time we kind of find ourselves into. Does anybody have any additional comments around that topic?
Yeah, I mean, just something small. I mean, on how I'd preface this, I mean, if us as Republicans are wanting to look at stuff like this and, you know, truly want to say a little, how can states get more involved? I mean, this is something that we should be telling our state legislator that we want more of. And though, trust me, I'm not a big guy on taxing, I know some states do a soda tax. I know some states do a quote-unquote sin tax for like alcohol and tobacco and stuff like that. Just small things like that, I think, although it wouldn't be in the numbers we're seeing people pour into food pantries, I think would be a good start. And that's just my opinion. I mean, I think that we're seeing that states can do more and they should do more. Not necessarily for people to lean on the states, but I feel like the states should not be sheltering behind the federal government.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree with that statement. You know, anytime we can give more control back to the state to take care of their own people, I think the better off we are as a country. I've said it all along. I'm from West Virginia. I firmly believe that West Virginians can take care of West Virginians. And we are the best at taking care of West Virginians because we understand them. Just like Texas is the best at taking care of Texans. Floridians are the best at taking care of themselves because they know the people. They know the demographic. They know the area. They know the culture. They know, everything about their communities. Why does the federal government sitting in Washington, D.C. in an ivory, quote-unquote, tower in the Capitol, making decisions that impact every one of our lives? We've given too much control to the federal government. And once you give away that control, it's very difficult to rein it back in or to bring it back. We as a party need to figure that out. How do we start taking power away from the federal government and return that power back to the state? We've seen some of that recently, but it would be great to continue to see that happen in the future. So kind of shifting gears a little bit to a little more exciting topic. Obviously, President Trump was elected to office last year and back basically a year ago. He was inaugurated in January, so he's been in office now for 11 months or so, give or take. So this is a big, we're seeing some of his policies, we're seeing some successes in the legislative side, that sort of thing. He's thrown a lot of tariffs and all of that out there. And he's helped negotiate some peace deals with some of the other countries out there. But I think, one of the interesting things that I've seen, I know Chase was interested in this topic, and I'm going to transition into it, is kind of the economic development that we've seen since Trump took office. You've got some insight on that, and such, Chase. You want to take it over?
Yeah. So, the main research I was doing here is I just wanted to know what kind of commitments we were getting as far as U.S. manufacturing and the people of America making products and everything, kind of the economy working out a little better here for us that way, as far as production goes as well. So just a couple announcements that I was able to find. So Apple had pledged $600 billion into the U.S. for manufacturing and supply chain, which was a big deal. I think that was released from the White House. So that was really cool to hear about. A couple auto manufacturers, which was interesting to me. So Stellantis, which, is Mopar, Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram, had pledged about $13 billion over the next 4 years for automotive manufacturing for, their cars as well as their electric vehicles. We also had pledges from Hyundai, which was good to hear. I think GM did as well. I didn't get to really look into that one as much, but yeah, so it was just really good to hear, a lot of jobs coming back to the States. Seeing products with a label made in America again would be really awesome because it's just so rare to see these days. But I did see one not too long ago, just on a car that, and it said designed and made in America. And I thought that was really awesome to see. I didn't think I'd really seen that before, to be honest with you. So a lot of pledges like this, I think it's going to be great to bring jobs to America. I mean, and open up new plants and even reopening old plants that had shut down. So it's going to be, I think it's going to be really good for our country to see that.
Yeah, I totally agree. So I did a little search on Perplexity using a little AI here to kind of help with gathering some research and information. As you mentioned, Apple made a $600 billion commitment to expand U.S. initiatives. Yes. Bristol-Myers Squibb, a $40 billion in research and development of U.S.-based manufacturing. Amazon, $20 billion to expand cloud infrastructure in Pennsylvania. $10 billion for a data center in North Carolina. Eli Lilly and Company, $27 billion to expand domestic manufacturing. Vantage Data Centers, $25 billion for a mega data campus in Texas with 5,000 jobs. Blackstone, $25 billion in digital and energy infrastructure in Pennsylvania. Global Foundries, $16 billion to expand U.S. chip making in New York and Vermont. First Energy, which is our power company here in the northern part of the state with Mon Power, $15 billion in infrastructure upgrades. GE Appliances, $3 billion and 1,000 new jobs in U.S. manufacturing. You know, these are just... Philips, $150 million in U.S. manufacturing. Hyundai, you'd mentioned, $21 billion, including $5.8 billion in a Louisiana steel plant. So there's been tons of commitments from these companies to continue to invest in the United States. And these are primarily U.S. companies. There's also been foreign companies that have agreed to make investments in the U.S., bring manufacturing and things to the U.S. as well. I mean, it's a great opportunity to onshore some of this stuff again and continue to boost our economy. And I think that's important. I mean, it's important for our economy, but it's also important for our security. And if we're not manufacturing these things and we're relying on countries like China or Russia or, you know, even Japan and so forth, I mean, some of them are our allies, some of them are not so much our allies, but relying on other countries for technology-related equipment is not a good thing, because every single thing we make pretty much has a microchip in it, whether it be a car or your cell phone, your watch, your hearing aids, your whatever, just about has a microchip in it, has a computer in it. And so much of that stuff is made and manufactured outside of the U.S. And we've got to bring some of that tech innovation back to the U.S. and manufactured here so that we can continue to innovate and continue to be a dominant player in the global economy, but also keep up with this AI. You know, we're seeing a huge shift in artificial intelligence, different types of artificial intelligence. I mean, you know, we've got so many different companies involved. You've got Google with Gemini. You've got OpenAI with GPT and ChatGPT. You've got Perplexity and their products, Anthropic. You've got all of these companies competing in the AI space. But all of this innovation there is going to require infrastructure. You know, they're going to need water because... data centers require a lot of cooling, and water is a great way to cool them. Also power. You're going to need a ton of power. And I'm going to tell you, if you live in this part of the country, there's not a ton of sunlight most of the time of the year. So solar power ain't going to get it. So we got to look at other ways of keeping up with the grid and infrastructure. So I'm really excited to see these investments, lots of data center investments, which I think are going to drive the AI infrastructure. But it really is a global arms race. You know, we're not building nuclear weapons per se in this case. We're building AI models, and whoever has the best AI model and the best AI capabilities as a country is going to win this race. And I think the ramifications of not being the winner would be huge detriment to our country.
Yeah, and to kind of hit off that one, I think the best AI model that's already out there is whatever sports bet books are using. I mean, FanDuel, DraftKings, they'll get you. Doesn't matter. They'll call a spread at 9.5, and somehow that game, even though both teams have been booty all year, they'll still somehow hit that spread. But also, another thing I want to bring up, we're talking about positive stuff in the Trump administration, which, you know, certain parties don't want to bring up, but, you know, kind of dating this podcast. But today, you know, the deal that Trump struck with the, you know, the pharmaceutical companies, making it to where, you know, we're talking about payments going from $1,000 a month down to $149 or up to $350 a month. You know, that's almost a $700 decrease, you know, when it comes to, you know, certain people, if you meet, you know, within that income value. You know, I'm just reading this stuff, you know, for Medicare and Medicaid programs, their pricing will drop, you know, specifically injectables to around $245 a month, you know, and if you meet certain income quality thresholds, we're talking $50 a month, people. I mean, I am not on injectables. I used to be, but I'm not anymore. I couldn't imagine getting it this cheap, you know, on as a normal person. You know, that's absolute insanity. I mean, these are just things that, you know, I wanted to pinpoint some positives that's happening in the Trump administration. As much as people want to get on here, or, you know, which is the main point of this podcast, you know, we're not trying to get on here and you know, be exactly, you know, like the internet. We're trying to be the opposite. You know, we're not trying to look at the other party and just say they're full of evil or anything like that, because the word and the conversation through parties, in my opinion, has been dead for a long time. I mean, I think, and this is my opinion, I think it really got bad when the government allowed companies to get in on the voting racket. I mean, that I think that is really when things started getting extreme. You know, obviously, I would like to point out that the opinions on this podcast do not, you know, replicate anyone, our peers, our bosses, anything like that. We don't, you know, represent anything but ourselves and our opinions, you know, much as we are as people. You know, they can't continue to evolve. And if for whatever reason or somehow or in some way, if we say something that's wrong on here and we need to correct it, we will. I mean, that's just the kind of people that you're dealing with here on this talk show, podcast, whatever you want to call us, you know. And hopefully, you know, when we're down the road, you know, we add more chairs to this wonderful podcast, you know, a couple listeners down the road, you know, whether you're sitting in the middle of the table or the back, I think now's a good time to kind of go into a segue. You know, what'd you guys have for dinner today? You know, I had a wonderful lasagna. My wife made it, and it was pretty good.
Go ahead, Chase. You're on the spot here. What'd you have for dinner?
Oh, yeah, let me think. You kind of did get me on the spot. I had a Subway. I had to get the Philly steak sandwich. It's solid, man. It's always my go-to anytime I go in there.
Well, I will tell you, your mother has become the absolute best fried chicken maker I've ever met. I mean, so we had deep fried, homemade, gluten-free, that's the key there, fried chicken that tasted better than KFC. She has really got that recipe down flat and perfect. So we had that, a little bit of corn, and what else? Oh, some potatoes that we made in the air fryer. So had kind of a pretty quick meal tonight, but it was so good. It was very good. Like I said, her fried chicken is amazing. So now everybody's mouth watering and everybody wants to go get some fried chicken, but definitely beats you know, those big chicken establishments out there that a lot of people purchase food from. But anyway.
Dang old big chicken pharma, man.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, when you were talking about pharmaceuticals, Ryan, you were talking about weight loss drugs primarily when you were talking about injectables. I just wanted to kind of clear that up so people kind of know those would be the Wegovy's, the, you know, those type of pharmaceutical injectable drugs, just so we cleared it up. Commonly used for weight loss and that sort of thing, as well as some diabetes treatment, depending on the particular drug itself. But I wanted to clear that up. This has been a really good show so far. I've been pretty excited about this and for weeks now. And we kind of got all the equipment together. We spent a little bit of time yesterday testing everything, and I think everything came together really, really well so far. Hopefully that the audience that's listening is enjoying the podcast. And let me do just a little plug here. So you are listening to the ECT podcast. And the ECT, yeah, I'll get it right one of these days. The ETC podcast, the Etcetera podcast, can be found on your favorite podcast apps. Subscribe to the podcast and listen to each one of our episodes that we'll be releasing weekly. And for more information about us and the podcast and to see past episodes, you can go to etcpodcast.com. Also, we'll be on social media as well, on X and Facebook and such at etcpodcast. So check us out and like us, friend us, follow us, help us build an audience here as we grow and continue to bring you great dinner table, tabletop commentary as we continue to grow. Does anybody else have anything that they want to wrap up the show as we kind of bring it to a close?
Yeah, just... look out, Big Chicken, because my mom's fried chicken actually is incredible, better than I've ever eaten anywhere else.
I didn't know you. Didn't know you tried it yet, but I guess you did. Cool.
I did. Yeah, I did. I don't remember exactly when, but I was up there when you guys had the fryer out and everything, and she made a whole batch of it, and I ate it not only there at the dinner table, but the next day as well, because I warmed it up, and probably after dinner that evening sometime.
Maybe after this is all said and done, we just get Colonel Mama on the podcast and she kind of divulged to the big pharma chickenceuticals how we get the real fried chicken done down here in the South.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, just to continue on with that, we did our family Thanksgiving a little early this year, a little different than we normally do. We kind of celebrated it last weekend, which was also Halloween weekend. So the grandkids came up and they trick-or-treated on Friday evening. And we had a nice little setup outside. We took the tailgate tent out that we normally use for the WVU football games and set that up in the driveway, put a little heater in there, and ordered some pizza from one of the national pizza chains, and just hung out and passed out candy to the neighborhood. Enjoyed all the family around, and then we had our Thanksgiving dinner on Sunday, which was pretty awesome. It kind of worked out really well for us. We got to see everybody. All of our kids came by, spent quite a bit of time with us, and it's always good to have family. I mean, we're a couple of hours away from some of our kids, so anytime we get a chance to spend time with them, it's always a great thing, especially the grandkids. Family's an important thing. I normally have these type of conversations with the kids, with the boys, every week or so. You know, we'll I'll give them a call on the way home as they're driving home, and we'll talk for an hour or whatever about whatever's going on in our lives. And that's kind of what I want to capture, is that just normal conversation that you have around the dinner table, on the way home, in the car, you know, just catching up with family. And that's what this podcast is all about. So without further ado, I do have a disclaimer that I'm going to go ahead and play. Just to kind of reiterate what Ryan was sharing earlier, and then we'll probably have our final wrap up as we close out the podcast. The views, opinions, and statements expressed in this podcast are for entertainment purposes only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the hosts, their affiliates, or any organization they may be associated with. The hosts represent themselves and only themselves. Any information presented should not be considered professional advice. Listeners are encouraged to form their own opinion and seek independent verification where appropriate. Okay, well, that was the legalese that we needed to clear up just to make sure that everybody's on the same page.